This month's mentor is no stranger to the Crown Council. He was a featured presenter in 2008 at the Crown Council annual event in Nashville, Tennessee. He is the author of the best-selling book, The Starbucks Experience, and the recently published book entitled Leading the Starbucks Way. As the fastest-growing brand in history, Starbucks is an interesting case study not only for branding and customer service, but for leading a leading brand. Joseph Michelli highlights leadership lessons from Starbucks that any organization of any size can use to build a better organization for its team members and its customers. With that, we welcome Joseph Michelli as this month's Crown Council Mentor of the Month. Joseph, welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's good to be back. It can't be that long ago, but I guess it's true. So,
well, we're eager to hear about your latest adventure and the lessons that you've learned about leading from Starbucks. So take it away.
Well, thank you very much. And, you know, this is, fortunately, I've written about other companies for those who are concerned about that. But Starbucks has called me back in my own, you know, journey because they're definitely demonstrating something that many of us face as a challenge. And I imagine many in your audience face as well. And that is the challenge of not only setting up a great brand, but then being able to sustain it through differing economic times, different customer needs. And so that was the reason that having engaged with this brand back in 2004 in the beginning of research that ended in 2006, that I reapproached them and we began working on this project that was released very recently. You know, you may be asking, well, why should I study Starbucks? You know, I'm in a very different professional services industry. Starbucks is in mass retail. I think there are the leadership principles that enable a brand to be robust through all of the different twists and turns are worth noting, and certainly Starbucks has been able to maintain its success longer than most people actually realize. And let's just take a look at, briefly at some of the success dimensions that the brand enjoys. Most importantly, it is defined by Fortune as one of the most admired global brands. Entrepreneur has it as the top 10 most trusted brands. Howard Schultz has been actually on the cover of Fortune magazine. It's one of those rare CEOs of the year. Social media-wise, Starbucks has continued to engage people effectively in a dimension that many of us continue to be challenged to figure out how to use effectively. They have 54 million followers on Facebook, much more than that actually probably today. They are among the top brands on Twitter and Pinterest. And they are also something worth noting just because of the sheer size of their labor force. Being able to run a company that has 200,000 people, while that may not translate to the intimate challenges of a small office or a chain of dental offices, for example, there is something to be said about the overall challenge of communicating leadership vision and translating it into the lives of 200,000 people, which then affect the lives of 60 million customers who frequent those stores, those 18,000 stores across 60-plus countries and growing every day in terms of the number of countries. Recently, they've gotten into Colombia, where Juan Valdez has had a grip as far as coffee shops are concerned. They were certainly getting coffee beans from Colombia, but they're actually selling into Colombia now. 42 years in the overall journey with Starbucks. They have been around since the early 70s. They are what I would consider an adolescent brand. They're not a startup. Much of the messaging in my first book talked about how they became successful in their startup phase, but clearly now we're talking about something very different. In fact, Starbucks was in trouble in around 2008, trouble that was causing them to close their operating units, some real concerns about whether or not they burnt out their growth engine, so much so that they would not be able to sustain stockholder pressures and really be able to deliver stockholder value. There was a fear of collapse of the business. Howard Schultz, who was then the chief global officer, he'd stepped down from CEO and yielded that to a guy who had been a big player in the big box store concepts for Walmart. Howard Schultz returned to the helm of the company in 2008, and he said we need to do a transformation plan. And so a lot of what we're going to talk about is how do you make sure that you can reposition your business whenever there are some significant challenges. The main message in this transformation plan, there were 7 bold moves that they defined. They focused mostly on people, product innovation, and technology. They thought with those 3 lever points, they would be able to do sustain the brand that was now starting to go in the wrong direction. I'll just contrast really quickly. My first book had principles like make it your own, which is a lot about making sure your patients have an ownership stake in the way the experience is crafted in their treatment planning process. Everything Matters was a lot about attention to detail, walking the store, making sure that you look at the entire journey of your patient throughout the experience at all the significant touch points. We talked a lot in the first book about surprising and delighting, making sure that you have the operational excellence foundation to consistently delight your customer, but then also doing elements of positive surprise that causes them to form an emotional connection with you. We talked a lot about embracing resistance and understanding that nothing grows in the absence of resistance. And we also talked about thinking in terms of your community involvement. So that was the old book. The repositioned messaging of this book is about savoring and elevating, loving to be loved, reaching for common grounds, mobilizing a connection, and cherishing and challenging a legacy. I'll go into each of these points in sequence here. So the fact that I ran through them in record speed was only as a context and setup. Let's talk about savor and elevate. If you think about Starbucks or you think about the people in your offices, one of the biggest differentiators between great brands and good brands are whether or not there's a passion at the frontline level for the product that's being sold. And in this book, I spend time articulating that there are many people out there who will tell you, you don't have to like dentistry to be successful in dentistry. There are a lot of people out there who said you can hate the product you sell and be very effective if you have all the right sales techniques, if you have all the basic customer management techniques. And frankly, there's plenty of cases to show that that's true. There are online providers who literally, you know, sell things like wedding linens, and they're on record as saying, I hate wedding linens. I wrote a book about Zappos, the shoe company, and Tony Hsieh, who did the foreword for the book and is the CEO, has 5 pairs of shoes, though he has a warehouse filled with hundreds of thousands of shoes and sells them and has very little passion for shoes. So it's possible to sell anything, including dental care, without much regard for dental care. So you can hire a staff that doesn't have much passion or interest in it. What Starbucks found is that they had lost a lot of their edge on product passion. They had not driven product passion. They had driven new store growth. They had driven some of the products in the stores had nothing to do with coffee. They had a lot of these baristas, these stuffed bears that they called baristas to emulate the name of the barista that serves you the coffee. They were getting great margins on these things. And if you wanted store over store growth, what you did is you loaded your store with a bunch of baristas, with a bunch of CDs, with a bunch of all kinds of other stuff, but not much to do with coffee. Unfortunately, while you were getting year in, year out store over store growth, you were cluttering up the landscape. Consumers were having a harder time understanding what was the business you were in. You couldn't find a coffee maker in a Starbucks for a while because all that retail space was being used by lower tchotchke type items. And so the real question is, does passion matter? And Starbucks concluded, and it's a big part of the transition, that they had to get back to helping people, employees, first and foremost, understand the unique nuances of their product. They had to get their people to fall in love with their product. They had to celebrate what they do with such excitement that people could say, you know what, I'm not just pushing coffee across the counter. I'm creating a positive experience for people over this remarkable product that's been around forever that not only is good for, you know, some health-related benefits if used in the right quantities, but also is great for communities. I mean, there are literally economies that are interdependent on the success of this. So a big part of this was driving the passion. They do a lot of celebrating and communicating through rituals, and I would think about this in your practices. You know, what can you do that is a consistent ritual that reminds people of the criticality of great dental care, of cosmetic attractiveness through your appearance and your smile? There's just a ritual that can be created. So at Starbucks, to give you an example of what this ritual looks like, I was at the corporate headquarters with the president of Starbucks Americas, and I was ready to just jump into an interview with him. And the next thing I know, he's saying, hey, before we start, would you mind if we just had a French press of coffee here? I'd like to share something we're about to come out with, and I'm really excited about it. Maybe we could pair that with some new food items we're putting out through our La Boulange bakeries. I'm like, wow, yes, absolutely. And that ritual of coffee tasting in advance of meetings is so common throughout the support center. It's common at the store level. If you're a new hire employee, part of the ritual is that they will sit down with you and you'll have a cup of coffee. Part of the ritual is you'll be given a coffee passport where you're encouraged in your early iterations within your journey as an employee to be able to taste a variety of different coffees from a lot of different experiences. They also take a subset of baristas from the stores, a small subset, but they take them to the origin countries like Costa Rica. They let these people pick, as I have, these coffee cherries in Costa Rica alongside of migrant Guatemalan farm workers. And the point is, you're going to get to experience coffee at its origins, the first 10 feet of the coffee journey. And you're going to get excited about what that means and what it means for these small farms and farmers in those areas. You're going to go to the processing plants. You're going to understand all of the nuances of how this coffee comes to market. And then you're going to understand you have a responsibility to deliver that product with expertise, with respect and reverence for all that this coffee bean has gone through to get to the last 10 feet of its journey where you hand it across the counter experientially to a customer. The other point here is they create a status level for expertise. You know, we get so into having people learn, and we require them to learn, and we force them to learn. We don't often honor autonomy. We don't offer their own sense of mastery. I mean, most people want to learn more about what they have. They want to be more knowledgeable. They want to have a sense that they can matter more through their knowledge. So what Starbucks has done is create a program that emphasizes autonomy, it emphasizes mastery, and it emphasizes purpose. And it's called the Coffee Master Program. No extra money is being paid to people who participate in the program. Starbucks has just taken the time to create a curriculum around coffee and coffee nuances and product and coffee tastings and how to do an effective tasting and coffee pairings. So they create all this education. You take the course yourself, you pass it, you then actually do a bunch of coffee tastings and you do that in front of various leaders, and you are then selected to be a coffee master. And for that, guess what you get? No pay increase. You get to wear a black apron. You're going, yeah, right, that's enough to do it. Well, it is, and plenty of people advance their knowledge base to wear that black apron. They also know they're more likely to be promoted throughout the organization as a coffee master. And then if you're really good at that, you can compete to be a coffee ambassador and represent the United States as the expert of coffee for Starbucks, and that's true in every other country as well. So clearly they've created expertise without necessarily having to compensate it, because they reward it through mastery and autonomy and through purpose. Now, if you really have your people getting into whatever it is in this aspects of nuances of cosmetic dentistry or reconstructive dentistry or whatever it might be, pain-free interventions, then what happens is you can translate whatever their excitement and their passion for this information is to the customers and get the customers involved in that same enthusiasm and passion, which is where it differentiates between two products that are quality. So, for example, my passion happens to be as a hiker and climber. So I was climbing a 14,000-foot peak earlier this year in Colorado. You know, before I go on these things, I actually go to a store to buy certain equipment. Now, I can go to a big box store where people have the product, but the employees have no passion for the product. They know no new nuances. They know nothing about emerging technologies, anything that's about to happen out there. Or I can go to a hiking store where people are living on the caliper. You know, they know what the product is coming out. They're going to show me what they got at trade shows. And clearly they're going to sell me much more deeply and build a relationship with me that builds more loyalty. All right, so it's not just about passion knowledge, but it's also about passion for experience. Hiring today, I think, we have a fairly good opportunity, I think, in the marketplace to hire people who are not only technically skilled, but who have the ability to create experiences consistent with what we want in our brand. So Starbucks has defined what they want the experience to be like. And this is a challenge I would have for you in your dental practices. Do you know what you want customers to feel every single touch of the way? And if so, does everyone in your employee have that same knowledge? And Starbucks has over and over again and constantly messages that they want people to have uplifting moments. I've often talked about it as creating the living room of the community or being that third place between work and home. But however you define it, they have specifically told people your job is to create uplifting moments in the life of a customer. They select for this. They do lots of interviewing to try to understand how much otherness employees have. Now, from a pure technical standpoint, making a cup of coffee isn't that hard. Being able to pull a good espresso shot is not that hard. The kinds of technical skills you need in your practice are far higher. So I don't want to imply that you'd ever want to hire below the technical skill standard. But I think there is a discipline to passing on a lot of people who are just technocrats and not people who are capable of creating human experiences. So there are certainly tools that are used. There are talent selection tools, various companies that specialize in helping you determine whether or not if you have two people of equal technical ability, which of them has a greater probability of having customer service talent. So Starbucks uses all types of tools. They then, upon getting a really, I think, and you can test this against your own experience. If you went into a McDonald's or you went into a Starbucks, where are you more likely to have somebody more service-oriented, other-oriented? And I suggest to you that they're both those employees are being, you know, available. They're both quick-service restaurant entry-level jobs. So, you know, it really comes down to selection as to whether or not you screen out some of the people who would want to be at Starbucks who might not be capable of delivering what they're hoping the experience to be. All right, so once you've got the right people, then you have to train them. You can't assume that if you train them on the technical skills alone, that's going to be sufficient. People with talent need some kind of guidance. If you were to try to be a world-class soccer player, and you had a world-class coach, you probably wouldn't become one unless you had some innate talent that's been latent. If, however, you did have that basic talent, you were given a world-class coach, you could go from being a really good player to world-class, obviously. So the point here is you have to have great coaching that matches talent. You can put a lot of coaching in, and if you didn't pick the right talent in the first place, all the coaching in the world will just leave people at mediocre. But assuming you've picked the right people, then you have to give them the tools. They spend a lot of time in training. They actually do training courses on what is the Starbucks experience. How do you deliver it? Here at Starbucks, you anticipate, connect, personalize, and own the experience. Those are the four dimensions they focus on. So it's not good enough to simply meet a stated need. You kind of have to anticipate a need. You have to see that person coming up to you in line, and you have to look, are they in a rush? Is their need state to just get a cup of coffee and get out? If not, how many other people are behind them? If there isn't, you need to anticipate the possibility of engaging them for a few words of conversation. In any case, you have to connect with them, and then you have to personalize the experience. Maybe it's as simple as asking for their name and writing their name on the cup. Maybe it's asking a quick question about how did that 14,000 peak hike go. And at the end of the day, you have to realize that every single person in this organization owns this experience. In a dental practice, and I just had a dental procedure yesterday. I've had my, I've had plenty of crowns, and I have veneers now, and all of that. And I've gone through so many experiences. And to be honest with you, I travel 4,000 miles to go see my dentist. I still have a dentist in Colorado. I live in Florida, and I schedule trips to have all these procedures done because they have come to know me, and everyone in the office takes responsibility for the experience that I have. They know more about me than just my dental care. They know about the challenges in my life in the last year, and they have been a source of emotional support and consistency for me as well. And so the message here at Starbucks is we got to deliver inspired moments, and we have to, each of us are responsible for that. It's not just what happens when the doctor comes into the room. There are many of pain points in the pre-authorizations, the payment, all of the prep time. And in fact, if you look at most service professions, when doctors come into the room, when dentists come into the room, when optometrists come into the room, the satisfaction levels are significantly higher than at most of the other touch points in the journey. All right, so beyond that, Starbucks has spent a lot of time creating experiences through environmental design, sensory enhancement. Sometimes it's about removing the clutter of your experience. Not everything that creates passion for the experience is adding new stuff. Sometimes it's getting rid of the things that get in the way of a very well-designed customer journey. All right, so that said, let's take a look at the additional pieces here, which have to do with making sure you're listening to your customers so you're driving a passionate experience. And at Starbucks, they actually have a formal website to do this. In most of our small businesses, it's a matter of having our own council of customers who are our advisory committee about the experience. And they're kind of insiders that are encouraged to give their input because we value them so much and because they are so aware and so capable of analyzing that which we need. So at Starbucks, they encourage their customers to log onto a website called My Starbucks Ideas. It looks a little like this. It's an open crowdsourcing website in that I log on, I share an idea, maybe I say I really want a peanut butter flavored coffee, and I wait to see what the rest of the members who are there do with it. They either vote it up or vote it down. Turns out I'm the only guy who wants peanut butter flavored coffee, and as much as I thought it was a great idea, I have to, you know, have to succumb to the realization that it's not that popular and it fades away. Otherwise, some idea may come up, like make sure you put the hours of all your stores on your mobile app, which was not there at one point in time. That idea surfaced. Lots of people supported it. Leadership at Starbucks communicated with the community on a regular basis about how they were doing it, making that happen. Ultimately, it happens, and the community feels like it's actually doing something to build the business. And that is true in professional practices as well. It's articulating that. Business principle in this book is called Love to Be Loved. Not something that most people think about in business. Love is not what we think about. Love and dentistry. Joseph, wake up. Hello. The truth of the matter is most of us want to be trusted, at least in business. I would say to you, many people are satisfied to just be trusted, to be the trusted advisor, to be the trusted healthcare provider, the trusted dental and oral care provider. Whatever that comes down to, it's probably not enough to just seek trust. Trust is a much better than satisfaction, but it's not the destination most of us are looking for. Trust does not necessarily cause people to advocate for us, and trust does not necessarily build loyalty. Certainly we're more loyal to people we trust than people we're not, but it's not the end stage that, according to much research, that delivers loyalty. To be loved as a brand, leaders have to actually be loving. The best definition I use for love is to care about the growth and development of others. So if leaders put their feet in places and their wallets in places and make business decisions that care about the long-term welfare and development of their people, their brands tend to create, the people inside the brand tend to leverage out and create love. So how do you go beyond trust to love? Well, confidence, if you ask consumers, are you satisfied with what I do? Are you likely to continue to be a patient of mine and repurchase my services? And they give you high scores, they're confident. If you ask them questions like, when something goes wrong, do we stand up for it? Do we do what we promise? And those kinds of questions, then you have integrity. If you ask customers questions like, I'm proud to be a patient of, and they give you high scores on that, now you've hit pride. And ultimately, if you ask them questions like, I can't imagine a world without your dental practice, I'm highly likely to refer your practice to a family or friend, or this dental practice is perfect for someone like me, you've probably driven up to passion and brand love. So my point is, if you really start wanting to look at what's going to predict long-term loyalty of your patient base, you probably want to ask more than, are you satisfied? Did we do what we said? You probably want to get up into this space of asking, does our practice fit for someone like you? And if they say highly, yes, it does, then you're designing an experience that makes it happen. If not, you want to start asking, well, what would it take for us to do that? And you want to start polling people, and you want to get your advisory committee to try to understand what is the difference between a brand in your space that delivers satisfaction and one that delivers passion. Well, how do you know if you're a beloved brand? My favorite way of doing this is look at referrals. You know, if someone referred a friend of theirs to be a patient of yours, and for some reason the person who was referred came in, they had a bad experience, they went back to the referring friend and said, I don't know why you like that dentist so much. And then the person who did the referral looks at them like this and goes, what? What kind of, there must be something wrong with the people I'm hanging out with. And then you know you're a beloved brand. Because what I'm trying to get at here ultimately is we as brands are like people. We are, people form relationships with brands at the same level they form relationships with their friends. And sometimes they'll turn on a friend because they're so in relationship with a brand that they're in disbelief that they could be hanging around such losers who would not care about their beloved brand. All right, so let's move on to a couple more points from the leadership principles of this book. I can't emphasize enough the importance of mobile today. I know that dental professionals have gone a long way into using mobile solutions. I see it increasingly in the care that I receive, notifications and messaging and all of that. But I am a huge fan of what Starbucks has done on the mobile app. And I think there are two reasons we need to think about it. The app is part of it. Part of it is also understanding how to get your products into the life of the customers beyond just the times that they come and visit your brick and mortar. So let's take a look first at the app. The Starbucks app starts with this basic concept that if I give you a gift card for, let's say, $7, and you then go online and register it with a couple of keystrokes, it becomes a loyalty card. So now not only is it a card that has $7 worth of value on it that you can use, if you attach a funding source to it, now you can replenish that card, and it becomes a payment card instead of carrying it around in your wallet. And we know increasingly that people are more concerned if they have misplaced their phone than they misplaced their wallet. They're more likely to know sooner that they forgot their phone than they forgot their wallet. They're so attached to this mobile device. They get so much of their world coming through it. So assuming that I now transfer it onto my phone, I now have an app, and I have a 2D barcode scanner. I can just use my phone now to pay at the register. And Starbucks was really the first large-scale wholesale retail strategy where people use mobile pay. And I got to tell you, I do it all the time. I go into Starbucks, I don't even have my wallet on me, I run in with my phone, and I pay. Once I pay, I start accumulating stars. If you look at the screen and the third screen, I start accumulating stars in a cup. This is a gamification strategy, which basically means that I am trying to attain a certain level. If I get enough stars in my cup, I get a free drink. I got to tell you, when I first went to Starbucks in 2004 and talked to leadership about loyalty programs and said, hey, why don't you give a 13th drink for every 12th people buy? They looked at me and said, because that would dilute the value of the first 12 drinks, wouldn't it? And they were right in 2004. However, times have changed. The loyal customers got Starbucks where they were. When Starbucks was in trouble, loyal customers backed off. Their frequency went down from 18 visits a month to 12 visits a month. That was sizable to the bottom line. So they rethought it. They've integrated it now. And the beauty of this app, and this is where I think we need to start thinking in this space, is it not only helps customers play the game, win the game, let their customers, you know, their friends know on Facebook when they've achieved the next level, whatever. It also enables Starbucks to get data on customers. So once I've got your card and I know you paid with your card, I know your purchase practices and your purchase patterns. And now they message back in through the app based on that. So I'm a non-fat latte drinker. And because of that, guess what messages I get sent into my app? Any announcement of any new low-fat product. I don't get every announcement about every product rollout. I only get those that they think are targeted to me. If they want to suggestively sell me into something, they're going to try to only suggestively sell me into adjacent concepts. So they're going to suggestively say, hey, you're coming in for lattes at 9 in the morning on average. How about you also try our new product? In fact, we'll give you a twofer on this thing. Well, wow. You know, they're suggestively selling me in ways that are relevant and customized to me. Just a point to know, this mobile device is an opportunity to collect data, it's an opportunity to communicate, it's an opportunity to understand your customer behavior and target your offerings to them more effectively. Last two principles of this brand, and you know, I don't know how much this is going to relate to you. Starbucks is a growth machine, right? So they go country to country, they're constantly looking to take on a new opportunity space somewhere. This may be true for you in a more local area, regional area. As you grow your practices, these principles are important to Starbucks because they got it wrong a lot of the times. Starbucks would drill into a new area and they would just deliver the same experience as they always delivered, and some areas just didn't resonate to that experience. So what they had to do is kind of say, okay, what do we really do well that everybody likes everywhere globally, and how do we make sure we maximize that when we go into a new market? And what is it that we have to start to customize? So some of the things they do well, and I would encourage you to look at this. If you're growing your business into the next neighborhood, the next street, the next town, the next state, I think it's important to say, what do we do consistently well that's going to play well everywhere? And so these chapters of the book address that. But for Starbucks, it was attention and appreciation. So they do a really good job of giving attention to people and appreciating their business. They are very good at getting involved in community, and pretty much everybody wants some attention, they want some appreciation, they want to be able to connect with community on their terms. Starbucks can create comfort, and they also have the ability to enhance variety. And as human beings, those are important, universal, ubiquitous traits that we all share, no matter what country we come from. However, they needed to figure out how to do things differently in different regions. So instead of running the entire business from Seattle, which is where they initially ran it from, they started to move their leaders out. So now there are leaders on the ground in Asia. There are leaders on the ground in Europe. So these are senior level executives who are in these locations now instead of running everything. Everything was run out of Seattle, Washington, and they were so disconnected from regional operation. And so they also come up with local partners. And by that, if you look at Starbucks, for example, in India, it took them forever to get into India, this giant opportunity space. It took them forever to get into, but as it turns out, they had to wait for the right partner. They had a couple of business partners who were going to help them get local, but finally they waited it out long enough, and now they're in a joint venture with Tata Coffee. Tata is the biggest name in India. They are involved in so many different sectors. And they have the infrastructure to make Starbucks successful in their launch there. So I think sometimes we have to say, well, you know, that we really do need some local partners who can help us figure it out. And then they had to be willing to customize some of the products in that marketplace. In France, for example, they changed the way they pull an espresso shot. In England, they've added a third shot to their normal two-shot beverage, whether it's a latte or, you know, a cappuccino, for example. So they've actually even changed the formulas on these things, which is, it just would not have happened in 2006. They realized that they cannot just force down the throats of people a taste profile. They can create this experience that's attentive, appreciative, and comforting, but they need to customize even the products that they offer. Okay, the last principle I want to go over in the course of this five-principle book is one that's absolutely contraindicated for most of us. I mean, I try to create the least amount of controversy and say the least amount of impassioned things that I believe in my business, and I've done it for the longest time. I try to just be kind of neutral and fairly vanilla and not really offend anybody, not really assert anything that's all that, you know, all that important to me. But boy, what a bad strategy relative to what I think Starbucks has really understood. Starbucks is in the news all the time. They're taking out some kind of newspaper ad saying that they feel this. Recently, it was about gridlock in Congress and how, you know, the two parties had shut down the government, and the ads were, we need to stand together to put pressure on Congress to get people back to work in the government roles. Prior to that, they were involved in making some comments about guns in the stores. They've been involved in discussions about gay marriage. They've been willing to take a stand regarding the last election cycle where literally Howard Schultz, CEO of Starbucks, comes out and says, we are committed to youth employment, and the United States government is not. We need to send a message to Congress right now that says, we are not sending you any more money for your campaigns, but instead, and this is bipartisan, we don't have a preference for one party or the other as it relates to this, it's bipartisan, but instead of sending money for the campaigns of these politicians, which will only install them for another cycle, let's take the money you would otherwise send, let's put it in a fund that's going to be a job creation fund. And so they did this ad. It was encouraged fellow business people to be a part of this fund, and it was also encouraged that the customers of Starbucks go in and give $5 and get this indivisible bracelet, and for that $5 they would put it in the fund. It would be seed money to small business. So play this out a bit. They get a very sizable fund as a result of it. There are small businesses that then seek loans from this fund. One of those small businesses, a place called Gelato Fiasco in Portland, Maine. Now, here's how this thing played out at Gelato Fiasco. Gelato Fiasco had been successful in a small town in Maine, in Brunswick. They then wanted to go to Portland near the university and open up another gelato shop. It would employ 6 people if they were able to do this. Well, they found a perfect space right next to the University of Maine, and they went to their bank and they said, should we sign this long-term lease? I mean, how likely is it we're going to be able to get funding? The bank said, oh, everything looks good. You're going to be fine. And they had to jump because there was some competition for the space, so they signed the lease. Shortly thereafter, the bank said, you know, on second thought, we really don't think the numbers add up as well as we think. So, no, you're not going to get the money. Now they're obligated to this long-term real estate issue, and they don't have funding. A couple of other traditional funding strategies also fail. Next thing you know, they go to the fund set up by Starbucks, and they get the loan. They open the Gelato Fiasco in Portland, Maine. They hire the 6 people It turns out they're actually selling coffee there, and they're also not far from a Starbucks. So you could even articulate that they were somewhat of a competitor to a local Starbucks store. Starbucks did not care, did not express concern, supported them, encouraged people to go over Gelato Fiasco. Well, now what? Well, Gelato Fiasco gets so successful that they're starting to send product into the supermarkets. They're now a consumer product goods provider in addition to these two storefronts, and they're selling gelato in the supermarkets of Maine. As a result of that, they make a sizable amount of money, and they reinvest that money in the small business fund. This is where Starbucks makes a difference, not only in the marketplace, which is, you know, it's all good sounding in the end, like, wow, look at how nice they are. But, you know, the point is, in order to get people to buy a $4 latte, they have to have a job. So this is not all self-serving, and I mean, it's not all fluffy niceness. There is a large self-serving part here about having a lasting legacy that helps employment, helps build small business, but also helps with the long-term success of their own business. Now, let's kind of take this and move it back into your space a little bit. The point of this is people are looking for brands with souls. They're not just looking for technicians to come in and do business with. There's so much choice and so much clutter. They want brands with souls. You know, when I went to the Crown Council event, Garth Brooks was performing at that particular event. And just remembering the social organizations that were associated with Crown Council and the Crown Council Dennis, it was clear to me you had a soul. You cared about smiles and kids and lifetime oral health and, you know, and people having a real sense of positive lives. And so this is a message that you need to stand on strong and be able to say to people, this is who we are. This is what we're about. Now, someone could say, well, who cares? I mean, I have a different charity. I have a different cause. I'm not all into that. I don't know, you know. But bottom line, most people are attracted to people who care about something deeply and importantly. For our cause and my organization, we're all over breast cancer. I lost my wife to breast cancer earlier this year at age 51, and I'll tell you, I talk about it a lot more than I used to. You know, that whole notion of let's not pick a particular cause because we don't really want to alienate other people. We'll just, you know, donate to the causes of our customers. Well, guess what? We'll donate to the causes of our customers, but we'll also make it really clear that our passions fall into that. And even on our website now, if you look at each of my employees, you'd find what their causes are and what we support. So we're very willing to call out. We want to have a positive effect in changing the course of breast cancer for women in the next generation. We want to change blank. And I think as a brand, it's important to speak like that because people want to be connected to something that cares about something, not just a brand that's able to take care of their teeth. They want to be not only taken care of, but they want to be cared about. Speaking of being cared about, I am so grateful to the Crown Council for once again giving me a platform and a forum to talk about some of the ideas. At the end of the day, if I were to summarize what this is all about, this journey, it's reminding ourselves that it's not good enough to transact business. We need to conjure up drive and look for ways to fuel the passion of our people, the purposeful passion of our people. If we do that, they can engage our customers in an understanding of the purposefulness of what we deliver, not just the technical skills that we deliver. If we take that another step up in our journey, we have the opportunity to create and define an experience we want our people to have, build it into all the touch points that we have in our business, and encourage our people to not only follow the procedures and processes, but actually be creators of experiences consistent with the one we define. Above and beyond that, we have to remember that there are many places and ways to connect with customers. Technology has allowed us to do a lot of that. It can't replace the human connection, but it can extend it, and it can make us be present in the customer's lives at times when they're not necessarily sitting in our office. And then finally, the strong final message is make sure that you express your soul as well as your skill in order to be a brand that becomes beloved, not just a brand that's liked or respected. That's the comments for today. I am greatly appreciative of being able to talk about the new book, Leading the Starbucks Way. And with that, it's back to you, Steve.
Great. Joseph, thanks so much. If you have just a couple minutes, got a few questions, just follow-up questions from the presentation. On the screen, by the way, is where you can order Leading the Starbucks Way, either at 800 CEO Read or Amazon, correct?
Yes.
Perfect. Couple of questions just for additional relevance to our everybody in the Crown Council. Oftentimes, I think we are led to believe that there is one way to lead. And you've studied this organization now for many years. Have you seen the leadership style evolve, or is it the same leadership style that's existed for the entire time that you've been involved with them?
It's totally evolving. And, you know, I'm talking about Howard Schultz, who's been at the helm for most of that time that I've been involved. But he's changed, too. I mean, first off, I think to be a great leader, you have to be visionary. You can't just be operational and tactical. I've come to believe that no matter what. There are great managers who can, you know, can do things right. And, you know, it takes leaders to see what are the right things to do. And so I think at some fundamental level, that's never changed. But what has changed is the approach, the humility of the approach, the amount of top-down leadership versus inclusive participatory management. I think there is a kind of a humbleness, a lack of cockiness that I'm seeing more and more in leaders today. You know, they don't have all the right answers. They are looking for people to help them form answers. They're able to make decisions based on data, sometimes limited amounts of data. They make strong, solid decisions. But in the old days, Starbucks felt more like a little bit more top-down, we're going to do it this way, to heck with, you know, some of the other inputs. And that's a little harsh maybe, but compared to where it is today, hugely different, much more humility.
If you had to break down some of those key lessons but make it usable to a small, you know, a smaller business, obviously nobody in the Crown Council has 200,000 employees, but a lot of the lessons obviously translate. What has stood out to you as being the biggest lessons that the small business can learn from a big brand?
We use them in our business because we also don't have 200,000 employees, and if we did, I don't know what I would do with myself. What we do, for example, at the beginning of every meeting is we talk about our mission, vision, and values, and then we have as a ritual, we talk about where we've done. We always tell a patient story or customer story, in our case, of where we nailed it or where we failed it. And we link those back to our mission, vision, and values. And we also have something called the Way We Serve statement, which is consistent with that uplifting moments thing I talked about at Starbucks. So in our cases, we treat every customer as a beloved boss whose life we want to make more relaxed, more successful, and more fun. So when we deal with people, that's what we try to deliver, and we make sure we talk about that, what that looks like. We give examples of some recent, you know, speaking events, for example, where we've been effective at doing that on behalf of the meeting planners or organizers, or where we haven't, and what broke down. And so I think what you see, that's a part of the ritual that I see happening in store meetings at Starbucks, that I see happening from senior leadership as they continue to feel passion for service excellence. So I would say that's something we can all do. You know, yeah, we can talk about the finances. Yeah, we can talk about the, you know, the breakdown in delivery of something to the customer. But we also should be talking about, are we living our values? And if so, how is that manifesting through the stories that we share with one another about the experiences? And some of those come directly from our customers, some of our direct observations of what a peer did to create an excellent experience. So at the end of the day, I think that's a big lesson that anybody can do with two employees or more.
One final question that has to do with what we call cause-related marketing. And you gave some great examples of things that Starbucks has done to do good in the community and to support other growing businesses. To what degree and what are some of the techniques that they use to promote those causes at the store level?
So there's signage everywhere. I mean, the old-fashioned signs around the store of what's going on in the community still are very effective. There are little fancier signs with QR codes, so people can do a quick QR scan right there and be able to pull up the details and information. Clearly, they're encouraging people to enroll in Facebook and Twitter and all the other ways in which they can receive messages tastefully and tactically. you know, and tactically about upcoming types of events. The partners themselves actively talk to you about, hey, it's Global Month of Service. We're going to be doing something at the park down the street. I don't know if you have time or if that's something of interest to you. But particularly for regular customers, there is a strategy of engaging them through conversation in activities outside of the store level. And the interesting thing is it not only caused marketing to cause people to come in or continue to maintain a relationship or advocate for your brand, a lot of those people turn into employees of the future. So what you see is a whole group of employees at Starbucks are what we call community builders. There are other subcategories that have been developed, like lifestyle workers. So community builders are often men or women who have a child in school. They're out of the workforce to be a primary caregiver for that child. They still want to work a little bit part-time, but around the kid's school schedule. They're involved in community. They care about school. They care about the community, the soccer, all that. And because of that, if we can get them involved in the community activities, they become more connected to the brand and they see employment opportunities as well. So it's interesting to me, when I think about cause marketing, I think I'm not only marketing for customer traffic, but also for future employee traffic.
You talked about vision, so let's talk about yours for just a minute. What's next for Joseph Michelli?
I'm working with Mercedes-Benz right now, trying to do something we're calling Driven to Delight. We're trying to change the experience at the dealership level for Mercedes-Benz. I'm working with Steve Cannon, the CEO of Mercedes US. And in 2015, we'll have a new book. Assuming we get this right, anyway, we'll have a new book. I'm under contract. I could see McGraw-Hill saying, well, you actually have this isn't working, so we're not going to write the book. But I think we'll have a book out in 2015. The numbers are definitely turning in our direction recently.
Excellent. Look forward to having you back when that comes out. Thanks for sharing Leadership the Starbucks Way. Look forward to reading the book and appreciate all your wisdom and great ideas and advice today. Thanks for being our Mentor of the Month this month. And thanks,
Steve,
for being
you here. And you and Greg inspire me. You both really, truly inspire me. And I know the people who are listening to this and viewing this have a great respect for what you do. I can just tell you, out of industry, you are extraordinary at what you do, and I am huge fans of yours. So, you know, when you want to do the Crown Council book, you just let me know.
You got it. Thanks, Joseph. Appreciate you being with us today.
Take care. Bye-bye.